Right, well, I wanted to kick off by giving you some background to recap where you've come from. If you're new here tonight, well, me too, welcome. I want to bring you up to speed with where you've come from so far in the book of Ezra, so what we do tonight actually makes sense. Now, God has actually always had a plan. Like right from the beginning, he's had a plan to redeem a people for himself. Started with a guy called Abraham and his descendants, and God's plan was to turn them into a nation, the Jewish people, the Israelites. And he wanted that nation to be a blessing to the other nations. He wanted them to be distinct, distinctly his. And he wanted to put them in a place, the promised land. And he wanted them to be under his rule. That was his plan, to have his people in his place and under his rule, to be a blessing to all nations. And the book of Ezra picks up the story where Israel is actually making a comeback after copping a serious beating. Like they'd been in that promised land as that nation. They had the temple all sorted out in Jerusalem where they're worshipping God, being his people. But then they disobeyed God. They rejected his law, followed other gods, the gods of the nations around them. And so God actually judges his own people and he boots them out of the land. How does he do that? He sends a nation to invade them. The Babylonians, they conquer God's people, put some serious heat on them, smack down their temple, take all the temple gold and silver, and then deport a whole bunch of the nation and scatter them abroad. So God sends his judgment with this big nation, Babylon. And for about 70 years, they're stuck in captivity in Babylon. And that's when God comes to their rescue. Like despite their sin and their failure, God comes to their rescue. And he does this by raising up a war machine, like the Persian Empire, who go and beat up the Babylonians, who've actually got, you know, God's people under the thumb. And then God changes the heart of this new kind of world leader, the king of the Persians. And he kind of issues a decree that the Israelites can go back to the promised land. God's people in God's place and under his rule. And he actually bankrolls the reconstructing of their temple. And he makes the other kind of mini governments around help chip in too. And this is a wonderful work of God. And in the first six chapters, which you've already looked at, you get this first wave of the Israelites returning home to resettle the land and to rebuild the temple where they could worship God. And they face some opposition along the way. They get hassled, they get persecuted. They're kind of politically hamstrung, but God moves the hearts of these kings who are in charge to keep it rolling. And finally, they finish rebuilding the temple, and they have this huge party, and that's what we're up to. God's people partying in the land, huge celebration. But tonight, what we're going to do is just kind of finish the book. Chapter 7 and 8 take place. You've got to fast forward now 55 years. Right, this is about 70 or 80 years after the first lot come back. And heaps of the original resettlers have either died or grown really old. And the ones who've grown really old have actually started blending in with the nations round about. They're not actually being the distinct people that God had hoped they would be. So God sends Ezra and a whole bunch of the other Israelites who are still in captivity back. And he says to Ezra, mate, go and sort them out. Go and teach the law. Get things back on track so they can be under God's rule again. Right? All that's by way of background. Now, you ready to dive into it? Good. That's hard work. We're ready to go? All right. I like Ezra. Like, he's a good bloke. This guy's a great leader. You know why I like him? I like him because he wasn't a hypocrite. You see this in verses 6 and 9 and 10 of chapter 7. It'll probably come up on the screen here. Ezra came up from Babylon. He is a teacher well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. For the gracious hand of his God was on him. For Ezra had devoted himself to the study and observance of the law of the Lord and to teaching its decrees and laws in Israel. Now, I like Ezra. He's a good man. He's a godly teacher and he's got integrity. Like, he doesn't just study the Bible. He does what it says. Like, notice the things that he devoted himself to and in what order he devotes himself to them. He devotes himself to God's word, spends time in it by studying it, then observing it, like doing it, and then teaching it. Right, he knew God's word, he did what it said, and then he taught it. Right? He's not a hypocrite. and God's gracious hand is on him. Today, one of my friends, one of the other pastors who I work with, he got ordained. And so the bishop came to our church, and heaps of other clergy came, and they laid their hands on him, and they set him apart for being like a presbyter, an elder, a pastor. And the bishop was preaching, and he said, "You've got to preach to yourself before you preach to others." And Ezra was that kind of guy. He'd preach to himself before he'd preach to others, because he'd obey it before he opened his mouth. Now, for those of you who are in leadership here, whether you're like, Bible study leaders, home group leaders, leading a kids ministry, a youth ministry, in some form of leadership, let me ask you, are you devoted to studying God's word, to applying yourself in a disciplined way to get it? And when you study, is the bottom line for you obedience for yourself, not just knowledge, and obedience before you teach it? The alternative to that's being a hypocrite, isn't it? This is an occupational hazard that I face. Every week, I've got to stand up and preach. And I want to be like Ezra in that. I don't want to be a hypocrite. There's one of the reformers, a guy called Calvin, said this: "It would be better for the preacher to break his neck going into the pulpit than for him not to be the first to follow God." So I'm happy I made it up the stairs tonight. Ezra was a guy who always made it up the stairs, because he did it before he taught it. You've got to get that order right, don't you? And God's gracious hand is on Ezra because he's a man of integrity. And I like Ezra. He's a good bloke, godly teacher. But Ezra's not the hero in the book of Ezra. It might have his name on it, but God is the hero in the book of Ezra. He's the one who's acting powerfully and graciously on behalf of his people. And despite all their failures in the past, and despite all their present failures as well, he's the one who's acting for their good. And God does it with his gracious hand. Right? It's a recurring theme in chapter 7 and 8, if you have a read. The phrase of the hand of God, or the gracious hand of our God, comes up 6 times. So you're meant to notice this. It's like a recurring, it's the chorus. So we're going to have a look at God's gracious hand tonight. A few brief kind of examples of how God's hand worked then, and we're going to finish with how God's gracious hand works today. So first up, God's gracious hand at work in the heart of the king, like just making him generous. In chapter 7, verse 6, Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given. The king had granted him everything he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. The king granted him everything he asked. And that is amazing, that God would move a king to be that crazily generous. Do you know what Ezra asked him for? Like, Ezra wasn't shy, right? He asked big. He said to the king, "Me and my people actually want to go home. We want to get on with worshipping our God." And the king says, "All right, but don't go away empty-handed." The rest of chapter 7 tells you what the king grants him. He gives him permission to go. He says, "Any Israelites who are here, go if you want." He gives him a massive government grant. Right? We're told it's more than like three and a half tons of silver is part of this grant. I don't know how much that's worth, but that's heaps. It's a massive grant. He gives him full cooperation with all levels of government. As they're traveling through, every government is not to tax them, but to actually give them anything else they ask for. He gives him full encouragement to preach his guts out when he gets there. He says to him, "Go and teach the laws of your God to anyone who doesn't know them. And if anyone doesn't want to do them, put them to death or throw them in jail. And go and set up a judicial system in your own country. Be a self-governing nation again." That is massive. And God's hand is at work in this king. And this totally blows Ezra away, like it wouldn't. He just praises his God. In verse 27 and 28, it says, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of our fathers, who has put it into the king's heart to bring honour to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem in this way, and who has extended his good favour to me before the king and his advisers and all the king's powerful officials. Because the hand of the Lord my God was on me, I took courage and gathered leading men from Israel to go up with me." Ezra's a cool bloke because he doesn't take the credit for being like, some kind of hotshot wheeler and dealer or being politically savvy with this king. He just praises his God because he knows that's a miracle. What king does that? What government just doesn't just ease up on tax, but just dishes out massive grants? He praises God because God changes hearts, and he rounds up the boys to get on with the mission. Let's press pause here. Like, God's gracious hand is powerful if it can change kings. Our God is sovereign. Like, ultimately, he is the one who runs this universe. Next Saturday, we are electing a new prime minister. But ultimately, it's our God who will direct this nation. Our God is a God worth praying to about national matters. Because he's a God who can change the hearts of kings, presidents, prime ministers, emperors, and whatevers. Do you pray to your great God for our nation? He's the God of the universe. And he can change hearts. So on election day, pray that God's heart, God would move the heart of our next elected leader, whoever that may be. So be at prayer for our nation. And that's what Ezra does when he hits a snag. He prays to this great, powerful God. In chapter 8, verse 15, Ezra says, I assembled them at the canal that flows toward Ahava, and we camped there 3 days. When I checked among the people and the priests, I found no Levites there. Now, you boys going on your surf trip tonight, you would have packed your surfboard. You wouldn't have worried about your toothbrush or deodorant, I'm imagining. But none of you are probably fussed about not being able to find any Levites to throw in the boot. Where's the Levites? We're going on a road trip. This is what Ezra's doing. All the boys are together. All the families are there. The bags are packed. And he looks around and he says, wait a second, we've got no Levites. And what's the big deal? You don't take them on your road trips. The deal with not having Levites is when they get to this land they're going to, they're going to worship God at the temple that's been rebuilt. And the Levites are the only qualified guys to lead the temple sacrifices. So going to Jerusalem to the temple without Levites, it's kind of like going to the stadium and not taking the team to play, or going to watch the launch of the next space shuttle and not taking the astronauts. They're kind of crucial to the whole deal. They make the machinery work. So he's like, where are the Levites? So he prays, puts the word out. Someone round up the Levites, tell them we're going. And you know what happens? A bunch of them, they quit their jobs, sell their homes, pack their bags, hit the road. Who does that? Why do they do that? Well, verse 18 and 20, because the gracious hand of our God was on us. They bought us Sherebiah, a capable man from the descendants of Mahli, son of Levi. He's a Levite. Verse 20, they also bought 220 of the temple servants. See, God's gracious hand is at work changing the hearts of people to be willing to make massive sacrifices to come and serve. These are real people. It's moving interstate to serve their God and their people. God does that. And this trip they're making, it's about 1,400 Ks through a desert, which is the favourite stomping ground of like bandits and thieves. But God's gracious hand's on them again. He gives them a safe trip. In chapter 8, verse 21, it says, there by the Ahava canal, I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and our children with all our possessions. I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from enemies on the road, because we'd told the king, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, but his great anger is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. Remember, Ezra and his people had been given heaps of stuff by the king. How much silver? 3.5 tons, right? And Ezra's told the king, God will look after us. And then he's like, ah, oh, we've got to get all this silver, 1,400 Ks, through the bandit zone. And so instead of like sticking all the silver in the armoured truck, which he could have with the armed escort, Ezra just tells everyone, all right, fill up your pockets, everyone. Let's just pray and hope we don't get bashed. That's the plan. Pray to their God. And, verse 31, the hand of our God was on us, and he protected us from enemies and bandits along the way. Then the exiles who returned from captivity sacrificed burnt offerings to the God of Israel. See, God's hand brings them safely back into that land, and they worship him at the temple by offering sacrifices at the temple. Now, aren't these chapters just jam-packed with God's gracious hand? You know, he's constantly working for the good of his people. He's powerful. He moves the hearts of kings so they become outrageously generous. He moves the hearts of the people to uproot and leave for the sake of serving their God. And he protects his people from being plundered. And I wish this is where the book of Ezra ended. Wouldn't that be a lovely end to the book? And they all hung out in Jerusalem at the temple, partied on, worshipped their God, big, you know, great time. I wish that was where it ended, but that's not how it goes. It's the beginning of chapter 9, tells us things are going to end on a sour note. After these things had been done by God, the leaders came to me and said, the people of Israel, including the priests and the Levites, have not kept themselves separate from the neighbouring peoples with their detestable practices, like those of the Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Ammonites, Moabites, Egyptians, and Amorites. They have taken some of their daughters as wives for themselves and their sons, and have mingled the holy race with the peoples around them. And the leaders and officials have led the way in this unfaithfulness. When I heard this, I tore my tunic and cloak, pulled hair from my head and beard, and sat down appalled. One of my friends named Simon has a Chinese girlfriend, and just this last week he said to me, things have hit a bit of a snag. Like, her parents have said they never want to meet me, they will never accept me, and that they want their daughter to break up with me because I'm not Chinese. And so we've been talking through about, you know, is this a cultural thing for her family? Or is this racism? Is this just a cultural deal? They should be respected. Maybe Simon should just break up and walk away to respect their culture. Or is this something that's not right that Simon should dig his heels in? This is what he and his girlfriend are trying to work through. Is that what's going on here? In this part of Ezra, God's people have taken on wives for themselves from other nations. And Ezra is appalled. He's more outraged than Simon's girlfriend's mother. He's appalled. He's pulling his beard out. He's ripping his clothes. Is that what's going on here? What's wrong with taking a foreign wife? This is not an issue of race. This is an issue of spirituality, of religion. God had said to his people, when you guys get into the land, I don't want you marrying other people, because when you do, you'll take on their gods and their detestable practices. And some of these detestable practices include stuff like child sacrifice. Don't get involved with it, because it'll turn your heart to other gods. So the issue for God is not just mixing races. It's actually changing gods. God does not mind Christian people marrying other races. In Jesus, we can all be one. There's no longer Jew or Gentile, slave or free. We can be one in Jesus. The issue is spirituality, not nationality here. But they had a clear directive from God. When they get there, don't mingle. Be distinct, be separate, so you can be a blessing to the nations. If you lose your distinctiveness, you lose your ability to proclaim my greatness and have the nations come in too as they see the difference I make to you. So Ezra is appalled. And you know who led the charge in this? Was the leaders, the ministers, the Levites. So he's pulling his beard out, because they're exactly where they were before they got booted out in the first place. Rejecting God's law and ultimately rejecting their God. So Ezra's appalled. He's been just so gracious to them despite everything. And they've turned their back on him again. And what God's people desperately need, once again, is what? Is God's gracious hand to forgive them, to change them. Let me ask, if God were to just assess your life, what would he be appalled at? What would he pull his beard out over? What would your friends and family be appalled at if they knew the darkest parts of your heart? What would you be appalled at if you could really see me? We all need grace, don't we? That's what God's people need, God's gracious hand. And the good news is that God is a gracious God. He doesn't quit on his people. Instead, he comes to their rescue. And God's gracious hand, right, wasn't just at work in Ezra's day, it's at work in our day today and tonight. God's gracious hand is at work in the hearts of his people. Because he's still powerful to change people. He's still generous to forgive. And he's still in the business of changing hearts and gathering people to himself. Now, I was disturbed this week when I was doing some reading on the book of Ezra. And a number of authors were kind of going down the track saying, you know, what's the key to getting God's gracious hand on your life so you can be successful, right, in all things? And they said, what you've got to do is follow Ezra as a role model, and then God's gracious hand will be on you. Now, Ezra is a good role model, isn't he, in terms of devoting himself to studying, observing, and teaching. But the point of these chapters is not copy Ezra so that you too can experience God's gracious hand because you've performed well. All right, the point is that God acts powerfully and graciously on behalf of his people despite all their failures in the past and despite all their ongoing failures. That's what's going on. And the Bible is actually clear that God's gracious hand is seen clearest, not when you succeed, but when you stuff up. I want us to finish by thinking about this kind of great promise that Ezra pulled out in chapter 8, verse 22. He said, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him, but his great anger is against all who forsake him. Now, God's grace is available to everyone who looks to him. The question is not really how can I get God's gracious hand on my life so I can be successful. The question is, what does it mean to look to God? What does it mean to look to God? It means to look to Jesus. The clearest picture you get of God's gracious hand is when it's got a nail driven through it, and it's covered in blood, and it's attached to God's Son Jesus, who lived the perfect life on our behalf because we couldn't, who died on the cross as the ultimate and true sacrifice for our sin, who rose from the dead, conquering our great enemies of sin and death, and who stands as the victor, offering forgiveness, a new start, and his spirit to help us change. Do you want to see the gracious hand of God in your life? Look to Jesus. It's the clearest picture you get today of God's gracious hand. Looking to Jesus means asking Jesus to forgive you, and he will. Looking to Jesus means asking Jesus to lead you, and he will. Looking to Jesus means asking Jesus to change you by his Spirit, and he will. God's gracious hand is on those who look to Jesus. The real question is, do you look to Jesus? Or do you forsake God? I remember it's about 5 years ago now, there was one day when I just was amazed at how our different people respond differently to grace. I was at the chicken shop, been for a swim, it's time for lunch. Caesar's meal deal. Chicken schnitzel burger, schnitzel hanging out the edges, chips and a Coke, $5. Who wouldn't be there? I'm in line, in my boardies, T-shirt, and the man in front of me, looked like a very successful businessman, or that's what he was trying to project, I assume, because he had like a full-on utility belt of mobile phone, pager. He was just had the works little thing in his ear. And he ordered a meal deal, goes to pull out his wallet, and he only had $3. Right? And I just said, "Oh, here you go, mate, it's $2. And he looked at me. He said, "Nah, I'm right, mate." And he walked out of the shop. I was like, "It's just $2. What's that?" He's just too proud, isn't he, to take a freebie. And then when I got home, drove into my street, I saw these workmen just slogging away, middle of the afternoon in summer, and it was really hot, and they were just sweaty. And I thought, I'll go and get them a beer. So I went to the fridge, grabbed 2 beers, and I said, "Do you guys want a drink?" And they just said, "Oh, yeah." No pride, no pride. They just chugged it down. They were just stoked. They happily received it. They are aware of their thirst, happy to receive it. Right? How have you responded to God's grace? He's not just offering you $2, right? He's actually offering you life, His grace, His forgiveness, the opportunity to change and grow, be His person. He's offering you eternal life. Now I'll be right. I'm a pretty good person. I'll be right. I don't need a hand up from God. I'm right. There's a serious warning to the proud in verse 22. Where is it? The gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to Him, but His great anger is against all who forsake Him. Like, ultimately, forsaking this offer is inviting the judgment of God, because someone will pay for your sin. It will either be you, or it will be Jesus on your behalf. I just plead with you, do not be proud. Accept God's free gift. Look to Jesus. Or maybe tonight, you are aware of your need. You're not too proud. You have a thirst. Jesus is on tap. A limitless supply of God's grace. Because my guess is the thing you need most right now in your life is just a bit more grace. What are you appalled at about you? What you need is grace. A fresh start to change again. And the great news is this: your worst sins, the dodgiest things about you, cannot disqualify you from this grace. Your best achievements can't qualify you for it. What's the key? You just need to look to Jesus. Hey, keep doing that.